And it's my desire and prayer, and I believe it is of most of the members of this congregation, that there be some response to the gospel before this day is over. When we see no one responding to the gospel for week after week after week, we have to begin to wonder what we're doing wrong. And perhaps with that in mind, I'd like to present this lesson this morning. I think we have a problem with leadership. And I'm not talking about a handful of people that are not leading. I'm not pointing to the eldership or to the deacons or to those people that seem to have some ability in leadership as we usually define it. I think leadership goes much deeper than that. And I suspect that we have a lack of it within the body of Christ. People in the world are always talking about the lack of leadership that fails to bring our nation to where we believe it ought to be, a lack of leadership that leads us into a moral degradation like we see in the world today. And I think maybe the same problem affects us here in the church. We look to other people to do things for us. We send our children to school and we say to the teachers, educate them, and send them back to us educated. Mark smiles at that. He knows what I'm talking about there. I don't know whether we have any doctors in the audience or not, but we send ourselves to the doctors. We have at least a nurse. And we say, make us well. And we worry about crime in the streets and our houses being burglarized and ourselves being cheated of our goods, and we look to the police department and we say, protect us. And when we talk about our eternal salvation, we look to that body that we call to the church and we say, save us. And it isn't working. Why? Well, we're beginning to learn in education that mom and dad have to do something at home too. That you can't just take children and send them off to an institution, because institutions are made up of people. The building may be there, but there's more to it than that. And we're beginning to see that parents are going to have to take the lead in teaching their children if they're going to have an education like we want them to have. And we're learning that doctors can't heal everything with a pill, or a shot, or a $15 visit. And we're beginning to understand that we have to take a leadership in deciding whether we're going to be healthy or not. We're going to have to start taking care of ourselves and watching what we eat and watching that we get enough rest and watching that we don't get too much tension in our job. And watching that we don't worry all of the time, we're finding out that it's a whole lot us and the lead that we take that determines whether we're going to be healthy or not. And all through our areas where we live, we're establishing neighborhood watches. We're beginning to realize that we are going to have to take a lead in determining whether we're going to have a safe neighborhood or not. And when we talk about our salvation and we look simply at the church as an institution, a place, a group that's just kind of a conglomeration that we have in our minds, and we say to the church, save us, we're going to have to realize that that's not going to work anymore without our leadership personally than it will work to have the doctor heal us, the teacher educate us, and the policeman protect us. The world is beginning to understand that about all of the other things around us, just like we've mentioned three of them. And we're going to have to start understanding that within the church. We need in the church elders who are willing to lead, not simply to push, but to pull and to show us where we're going. When we have preachers preaching that we ought to do this, that, or the other, we're going to have preachers that get out and show us how to do it and not just push us. And when we're going to be parents trying to raise our children as Christians, we're going to have to get out and show them how to live, not simply push them in the direction that they need to live. And when we talk about as individual members the need to save souls, and when we cry and sob because we know that there are 25 or 30 people that once were members of this church or were once children of ours who are not here today, we're going to have to take the lead in doing something about it. We need to take control of our lives. And one group I haven't talked about much yet, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it now, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it right at the end of this lesson. And that's those of you that are here this morning that are not Christians. You know, we're talking about leadership, and it applies to you too. You're going to have to take some leadership over your own life. You know, anyone can just sort of follow the crowd and go with the flow, as they say. That's not difficult. It's not difficult to do what the guy next to you and the whole crowd around about you is doing. It's much more difficult to stand out alone and take a direction. It's much more difficult to become a Christian, to make a commitment, and then decide you're going to carry on. It takes control of your life. You're going to have to lead in that regard. I'd like to go back to the Old Testament and look at four different examples of great leadership as I see it. And I left my Bible on the seat. Ezra, could you get me my Bible there? No way, he's ready to do that yet. Well, I picked four leaders that I have a vested interest in to preach about this morning. And I have a dual purpose for using these four different leaders. One, to make the point that I'm talking about this morning. Another, perhaps a more personal reason. The first leader I'd like to talk about is a fellow by the name of Joshua. Joshua's name in Hebrew means Jehovah is salvation. And translated into the Greek, it's the same word that translates Jesus. The first time we run across Joshua is when he's commissioned to be a spy for the land of Israel, for the tribes of Israel. He was one of 12 who was selected and was sent into the land of Canaan after the children of Israel had come out of Egyptian bondage and traveled for quite some time and come to the promised land the first time. 12 men, including Joshua, were sent into the land of Canaan to spy it out, to see what was there, to see how powerful the people of that land were, and to see what the vegetation, what the crops, what the cities, what everything in that land was like. They went in for 40 days and looked about that area of Canaan. They saw a rich agricultural area, just like God had promised. They saw cities that were walled and fortified and strong. And they saw people in that land that were bigger than they were. Some of them were even described as giants, the children of Anak, huge people. And those 12 men, including Joshua, came back to Moses, and they were told to report on that land, and they gave that report. But only 2 men out of those 12 said, "Let's go in and take the land. We can do it." They saw the same thing that the other 10 men saw. Joshua and Caleb said, "We can take it because the Lord is with us." That's the first time we run across a man who would become a leader in Israel by the name of Joshua. They recommended taking the land. If you would please turn with me back to Numbers. I believe it's the 14th chapter, verses 1 through 10. "And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, and would God we had died in this wilderness. And wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land, to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said one to another, "Let us make a captain, and let us return into Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. And they, that is Joshua and Caleb, spake unto all the company of the children of Israel, saying, "The land which we pass through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Not fear not them." But all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. Here Joshua and Caleb stand up for what they've said, and it nearly gets them stoned to death right there on the spot before the children of Israel. Well, Joshua turned out to be rewarded for the position that he took, a leadership role that he took. You know, when you have 12 people go in to do something, and only two of them want to do what's right, it takes leadership to stand and to hold that position. Now let's make some application of that today. This little body of people here in Beaver Creek is a handful of people compared to the vast population that lives around about us. It takes leadership for every one of us to stand up and say what's right when people are perhaps not going to throw stones, but they're going to throw barbs, they're going to throw insinuation, they're going to throw us names, they're going to infer that we're fanatics, they're going to infer that something's a little bit strange about us. It takes leadership to do that. But Joshua went so far as to stand up, even to the point of possibly being stoned to death, to say that we can take the cities of Canaan. What was the basis of Joshua's leadership? You know, so many of us, and I feel this every day, think I'm not cut out to be any kind of leader. I'm cut out to be a follower. I wonder what it was that motivated Joshua. What is it that motivates anybody to be a leader? Well, I think one of the things that made Joshua a leader was that he had confidence. You know, the thing that makes leaders today is confidence in part. They have a confidence that what they are doing is right. They have a vision for what needs to be done, and they go about to do it. Joshua had seen a lot. He was born in Egypt, a slave, not exactly the type of background we usually think of a leader coming from. But he had been born in bondage in Egypt, and he had seen the release of God's people. If he didn't see it, he heard about the plagues and the miracles that Moses performed before the Pharaoh. He saw a small band of Israelites led by God, go right out of bondage, leave Egypt behind. He saw the Red Sea parted by God, and he saw manna, food, fall from heaven to the ground miraculously. He saw all that, and he understood the power of God. You know, if we had half the amount of confidence that Joshua had in the power of God, there'd be a lot more leaders among us out there doing something for the cause of Christ. Joshua had a sense of direction as well. He knew where he planned to go. He knew where God wanted him to go. He had a sense of what needed to be accomplished, and he was prepared to follow through. That's what leadership is about. A leader has to know where he's going and where he wants to take people with him. Let me reread a little bit of what we just read. In the 14th chapter, beginning with verse 6. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. And they spake unto all the company of the children of Israel, saying, The land which we pass through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us, their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not. Joshua, after seeing all the things that he had seen already, understood that this land was promised to the children of Israel. And you know, I think he understood that God could fulfill his promise. A God that could leave Egypt littered with the dead of the firstborn of that nation. A God that could take the Red Sea and make the walls stand back and let the children of Israel walk across on dry land. A God who, when they began to murmur about not having any food, could make it virtually rain out of heaven, could give them the land of Canaan if he wanted to. We worry about whether we can get out and preach the gospel, and whether we, because we don't have much education, or we don't have ability to get out before other people and speak. And we worry about all of these different things, but we forget all about the power of God that stands behind us. Now, how could people take the land of Canaan? A little tribe, there might have been 2 or 3 million of these Israelites, but they were talking about going into a whole region, a whole country, and try to take it over. And these people were big. They were giants. Sure. If they didn't have the power of God, if they weren't convinced that God was helping them, there would have been no confidence to lead a band of troops into that region. But Joshua had confidence. He had a vision for what God intended to be done, and he didn't worry about the details like that. He said God would lead them. We see that eventually Joshua becomes the replacement for Moses as the leader of Israel. Moses dies, and the most that he gets to see is the promised land from the mountaintop. It's Joshua that then assumes the command of Israel, assumes the position that Moses once held, and he prepares to take the land of Canaan. Numbers 27 describes the change of command that took place. He's given a sense of purpose, an objective. Moses speaks to him about what he's to do. God tells him what he's to do. And Moses has his sense of purpose, his direction. He knows where he's going. He has confidence in what he's about to do. We can turn over to Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter, and we read an account of what did occur. In the 31st chapter, and verses 3 and 7, The Lord thy God, he will go over before thee, and he will destroy these nations from before thee, and thou shalt possess them. And Joshua, he shall go over before thee, as the Lord hath said. Then verse 7, And Moses called unto Joshua, and said unto him, In the sight of all Israel, Be strong and of good courage, for thou must go with this people into the land which the Lord has sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. Joshua was going to be a very instrument in causing the promise of God to come true. Let me repeat that. Joshua was going to be an instrument in causing the promise of God to come true. Now, how does that relate to us? God wants to use you and me to lead others to see the promise of God fulfilled. God made the promise that whosoever would believe on him repent of their sins, confess Him before men, be baptized for the remission of their sins, and then live faithfully, would inherit heaven. That's the promise. God can carry it out. But as Brother Hoagland talked all week about, he uses human instrumentality, as he wanted to say it, to cause that promise to be fulfilled. And that takes leadership on your part and on mine. People that don't hear about the gospel, people that aren't taught about the gospel, are not going to receive the promise. We are going to have to be a part of causing God's promise to be carried out. Joshua had faith that God could perform everything that he said he would perform. And that faith was manifested when they took the city of Jericho. Again, it did not seem the most logical way to take a city. God told Joshua to take his troops in, to march around the city one time for each of 6 days. On the seventh day, to march around seven times, to blow their trumpets, and he said, the walls of the city will fall down. Incredulous. Hard to believe. No, not really for Joshua. He'd already seen the walls of the sea rolled back. He'd seen the plagues of Egypt and he'd seen the manna from heaven. It wasn't that difficult for him. Another important factor about a leader and having leadership qualities is that we have faith in what we believe. Faith that motivates us to keep going even when other people say, that's ridiculous. And anybody ever have someone tell you when you told them something about the gospel, that's ridiculous? We start believing it. We get sometimes like the children of Israel. They had seen all this stuff just like Joshua had, and here they are ready to go into the land of Canaan, and they say, let's run back to where we were before. Let's go back to bondage. Let's go back to making bricks in Egypt. Let's go back to plodding all day in the straw and the clay, making monuments to Egypt. They forgot their promise, and they lost their faith. The leaders of Israel, though, did not, and Joshua was an excellent example of that. Another thing that made Joshua stand out as a leader was that he was persistent. In Joshua 11, verses 15 through 19, we read this. As the Lord commanded Moses his servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses. So Joshua took all the land, the hills, and all the south country, and all the land of Goshen, and the valley, and the plain, and the mountain of Israel, and the valley of the same, even from the Mount Halak that goeth up into Seir, even unto Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon, under Mount Hermon. And all their kings he took, and smote them, and slew them. Joshua made war a long time with all these kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All other they took in battle. Joshua did all that the Lord commanded him to do, all that God through Moses commanded him to take. He took all of the land that laid about that area. He was persistent. He didn't take just Jericho and quit. He went ahead and finished the job. The final thing that I'd like to point out about Joshua was that he led right up to the point of his death. He didn't lead just when he was young, or just when he was middle-aged, or just when he was in his senior years. He led right up to the very point of his death. When Joshua was about to die, he gathered Israel about him, at least the leadership thereof, and he recounted everything that we've recounted this morning. He took them from the time that they were in Egypt to where they were at their present time. He showed them the glory and the power of God. He showed them what God had done for them. He showed them that God had fulfilled his promises, and he begged of them to continue to be faithful. Then in Joshua, the 24th chapter, in verses 14 and 15, we have the words that probably are most often used in connection with Joshua. As he was about to die, he said this, "Now therefore fear the Lord, and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we shall serve the Lord." That pretty much capsulized the life and the leadership of Joshua. There's a lot we can learn from that lesson. There's a lot my Joshua can learn from that lesson. That you have to stand out and be different and lead and not go with the flow, as they say these days. But another great example of leadership that we find in the Bible is a man by the name of Josiah. That word in the old Hebrew meant Jehovah supports him. Josiah was a king of Israel. He reigned over Judah after the kingdom had become divided. It was a time of great wickedness when Josiah assumed the throne. Manasseh was his grandfather. Manasseh promoted idolatry. He built altars. In fact, he built or rebuilt altars that Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. We get some idea of the conditions in the land at the time Josiah became king from 2 Kings, the 21st chapter, verses 6 through 9. Again, this is speaking of the conditions in the time of Manasseh. "And he made his son pass through the fire, and observed times, and used enchantments, and dealt with familiar spirits and wizards. He wrought much wickedness in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. And he set a graven image of the grove that he had made in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son, 'In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all tribes of Israel, will I put my name forever. Neither will I make the feet of Israel move any more out of the land which I gave their fathers, only if they will observe to do according to all that I have commanded them, and according to all the law my servant Moses commanded them. But they hearken not, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than did the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the children of Israel.'" Immediately before Josiah became king of Israel, his grandfather Manasseh had restored all of this idolatry. He was making his own son walk through the fire in worship to Molech, actually burning their children to death in offering to a heathen idolatrous god. He'd actually taken images and put them in the house of God, the place where God said he would dwell. He'd seduced the children of Israel into doing all of this. Amon was Josiah's father, and the Bible says that he did just like his father, or Josiah's grandfather, Manasseh. So there was a great deal of wickedness going on. I guess the point that I want to make concerning leadership this morning is that we're going to see that being a leader has nothing to do with parentage. You know, even some of the commentaries I went back to read to kind of get ready for this lesson kept talking about leaders being born. Well, I don't think leaders are born. I think leaders decide to be leaders and they make themselves leaders. Because Josiah is an excellent example of that. His father and his grandfather were about as rotten and no good as any two men could be. They had taken the people of God and seduced them, taken them away from Jehovah, had taken them into idolatry, were butchering their children in sacrifice to an idol. And they had even desecrated the temple of God by dragging all of this in there into the house of worship. Josiah assumed leadership of Israel at the age of 8 years old. Now, I don't know whether he really led at 8 years old or whether all of the king's secretaries and cabinet members pretty well took control of that for a number of years or not. I kind of assume that might have been what happened. But he became king at 8 years old. And I would like to make the point that leadership doesn't require a great deal of age. And that's a point to be made for everyone that's here that, as Brother Hoagland liked to say, had an IQ to understand what I'm talking about. Even my Josiah can understand that he has to take a lead in doing what's right. Others are going to try to take us away from what's right, and we have to lead. Several of you here this morning who are in your teenage years, or maybe just beyond that. And too often in the church we leave the impression that the only people who do any leading are the elders, and they have to be older. Well, they do have to be older to be elders, and that is a leadership position, but it's not the only leadership position in this world. Every one of us, in some capacity or the other, has to be a leader, or needs to be. And some of you that are young need to learn the point and maybe take Josiah as an example of how a very young man can lead a huge group of people to do what's right. Too often we have this idea that we spend our young years doing whatever pleases us and kind of going with the crowd and getting our enjoyment out of the way, and somehow down the road a little bit, all of a sudden when we hit 30, we're going to change and be a different person. Well, I just passed 30 about 5 years ago and nothing really changed. Nothing changes as far as the way you think and the way you behave because you hit a certain age. It just doesn't work that way. And we need to be taking our young years, the years when we've got the energy and when we're most influential to other people who are still making up their minds about things, we need to be using that time to lead. There's probably no greater leadership that could occur in the Lord's church than to have young people take a lead. Now, a lot of the older people here are kind of, as we say, set in their ways. And it takes a whole lot to dynamite us out of the way we think. But among young people, from the age of 12 to 21 in particular, at that age we're trying to mold our thinking, we're trying to decide what course we're going to take. And if a young person knows where he's going, knows that he or she is planning to go to heaven, and knows that the Bible is what takes us there and what directs us, there's no more powerful leader on this earth than a young person telling his friends in the same age group those issues. Nobody can be more powerful in shaping people toward righteousness than a young person influencing and leading other young people in that direction. But all too often we sit back and we think, this is not the time for me to lead. My time will come on down the road. And those very same people that are sitting next to you right now, when you finally decide at the age of 30 you want to lead, they're not interested in what you have to say anymore. They're beyond the state of having their minds molded and shaped and being willing to listen. Young people are willing to listen. Old people a lot of times aren't. It's an area that we need leadership in. Josiah collected money of the people when he became king, and he rebuilt the temple, which had been desecrated, damaged by his father and his grandfather before him. He finds the book of the law of God And apparently, I may be assuming something here, but I think maybe it's a logical assumption. I'm presuming that his father and his grandfather must have made a concerted effort to destroy the law of God, to burn it up, to do away with it, because when Josiah orders the rebuilding of the temple, while they're doing that, one of his servants finds a book of the law. And it's like, surprise, here it is. I've never seen this before, is Josiah's reaction to it. He gets into it and he has it read to him. And he finds out all of the things that God has commanded, and he sees that Israel is doing none of it. Judah is doing none of it. And it comes to him as though it were to someone who had never read a word in the Bible before. So I'm assuming that there weren't many books of the law lying about. He happened to discover one in the rebuilding of the temple. And when he learned what God wanted him to do and what he wanted his people to do, Josiah set out to see that it was done. He burned the images and the altars and the vessels of idol worship. He ground them down to powder. He took the idolatrous priests that had been worshiping all of these idols and he had them killed, executed. And he ordered a resumption and a keeping of the Passover once again. Josiah was a leader of a great restoration movement. You know, we talk about the restoration movement that occurred in the late 1700s and the early part to the mid part of the 1800s in this country. And we think about those men that are so common to us in name, the Campbells and the others who helped lead that restoration. Well, it's good to look at them, but Josiah was an example of a restorer long before any of those men ever lived. He took a wicked, idolatrous people of God, and he brought many of them back to the truth. The Lord paid him a tribute for his leadership. The Lord was prepared to destroy Judah, prepared to send them into bondage, and he essentially put that on hold for the lifetime of Josiah. He let Josiah try to lead the people of God back. He put on hold his wrath and his anger for the time that Josiah lived. Josiah led against the popular trend. He didn't do what was popular in his time, but he had a purpose, he had a vision of what was right, and he was committed to seeing that it was done. He was a reformer, a restorer. When Josiah was finally killed in battle, Jeremiah the prophet and all of Judah mourned the loss of this king, the last righteous king of Judah. Another leader we want to look at a moment is Ezra, whose name means help. And I think the idea of being a helper is key to our understanding of what leadership is all about. Ezra was a priest and a scribe. He was a religious reformer. He lived during a time when God's people were in bondage. After the kingdom had been divided and after it had gone into captivity because of its sins under the Persians. God's people had been punished after the time of Josiah and the last of the kings that would have anything to do with God's will. God let Israel and Judah go into bondage, and it was during this period that Ezra lived. But somehow or the other, Ezra has enough leadership about him, enough leadership quality, enough ability to convince even the king of Persia, the one who ruled over them, that there was a need to make a restoration in Jerusalem. From King Artaxerxes to, number one, return to Jerusalem, to collect money from the children of Israel to rebuild the temple, to get enough money out of the king's treasury itself to buy animals in the thousands for sacrifice unto God, to relieve the Jews of that time of taxes, tolls, and other customs so that they could get back to doing the Lord's work. Artaxerxes gives Ezra power to appoint public officials in Jerusalem. He gives Ezra capital power, that is execution power, over the people of Israel if they don't do what God wants them to do. Now you talk about a man with leadership who can go up to the very one who has his foot on your neck and convince him to let you go back and worship the God of Israel. Ezra had that kind of leadership about him. Ezra apparently was extremely convincing in his arguments. We understand from Ezra, the 7th chapter, in verse 23, that he was convincing enough that the king of Persia didn't want anything to do with crossing the God of Israel. Artaxerxes says, "Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons?" Ezra convinced King Artaxerxes that to not obey God could be very difficult for Persia and its allies. Ezra leads a great reform. You know, Josiah had attempted to accomplish this, and he had brought some of the people back, but as soon as he died, things went right back like they were before, and the children of Israel were carried off into captivity. The captivity is nearly now over. Years and years have passed, and now Ezra is going to take the lead in trying to take a beaten and submissive people back after they've learned their lesson, after they've been disciplined, to lead them back into God's way once again. You know, there's a need for that kind of leadership today, too. There's a lot of us who have been Christians, who are Christians, but haven't been living like we ought to, and there's a great need for leaders to find these people and bring them back to the way God would have us to live once again. That's the kind of leadership that Ezra provided. The people had intermarried with the heathen. They'd picked up idolatry from their spouses that they'd married while in captivity. And Ezra saw the broader picture of what was going on. And again, that's an example of what a leader must have, and that is a broader vision of what's happening, and not just focusing on what's happening now or this particular situation, or what I would like right at this moment, or what would be most conducive right now. He saw the broader picture of what was going on. In Ezra, the 9th chapter, in verses 7 through 15. "Since the days of our fathers have we been in a great trespass unto this day. And for our iniquities have we, our kings, and our priests been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, and to a spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. And now for a little space grace hath been showed from the Lord our God, to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a meal in this holy place, that our God might lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And now, O Lord our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments, which thou hast commanded by thy servants the prophets, saying, The land into which ye go to possess it is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people of the lands, with their abominations, which have filled it from one end to another with their uncleanness. Now, therefore, give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever, that ye may be strong, and eat the good of the land, and leave it for an inheritance for your children forever." Well, Ezra sees the broader picture of what's going on here. Not just that it would be nice to marry this woman, she's pretty,
Maybe she cooks well. She's enjoyable to be with. She has a pleasant personality. He looks beyond that and he sees what all of this intermarrying has done to the people of Israel. You know, we're affected by the people closest to us. They have an influence. We've talked about influence before. Ezra saw that the influence was great enough that something had to be changed. Ezra ordered the divorce of all of these strange spouses. He said those that refused to do so would lose all of their material goods, and they would be virtually excommunicated from Israel, put away, separated from, if they refused to do so. Nehemiah, the 8th chapter, 9th chapter, and 10th chapter tell how Ezra preached and helped restore the people to God's will, even under great adversity. And one point I'd like to make about Ezra's leadership. The children of Israel in the time of Christ were not living like they should have been living, for the most part. But never did they ever go back to the kind of idolatry they practiced before that time. I guess the major point to be made here about Ezra's leadership is that a person can lead even when they are subject or under the authority of another person. And I make that point to some of you who are women in this audience. Some women believe that they cannot lead because they're subject to their husbands. They're under the authority of their husbands. You certainly can lead. Not in the same way, perhaps, as your husband might. Some of you who are children assume that you cannot do any leading because you're under the authority of your parents. Wrong. You can lead, and you have a responsibility to lead. Sometimes we think because we are the employee of a particular company that we can have no leadership in that organization, either of a physical type or of a spiritual type, and we're wrong if we think that. We need to lead. And finally, and very briefly, the last example I'd like to look at of leadership is a man by the name of Amos, whose name means burden bearer. Amos was a herdsman and a farmer from a small mountain village. Not exactly the breeding stock of great leaders if you look at the books about leadership that you might read today. He lived during the reign of Jeroboam II in the Northern Kingdom. It was a time of great prosperity, kind of like what we have now. You notice the circumstances are yet different than the other three leaders we talked about. There's a great deal of prosperity, just like we're enjoying here in the Miami Valley right now. It was also a time of great corruption and idolatry too, because as these people had so much, they began to turn away from God. Amos 2, verses 6 through 8, and Amos the 5th chapter, verses 11 and 12, tell about all of this and about the Baal worship that was going on, all of the things that were rotten, even in the midst of prosperity in the Northern Kingdom. Amos wasn't really a part of the Northern Kingdom. He lived down in Judah, below Jerusalem. He went from the Southern Kingdom and traveled up to the Northern Kingdom, and there he began to teach. Furthermore, Amos wasn't a prophet or a preacher by occupation. He didn't have any credentials. I mean, he didn't go to school to learn to be a preacher or a prophet. He was just a herdsman and a farmer, but God asked him to go up there and preach, and so he did. He preached against the idolatry. He preached against the robbing of the poor. He preached against the ignoring of God's law. You know, this herdsman had quite an impact. Amos 7, verses 10 through 17 tells about the impact that Amos had. We could go into more detail if we had time. But this man, who seemed inconsequential in terms of position in this life, traveled far away from his home and taught the Word of God to people who were strangers virtually to him.
and he had an impact. The point of that, as far as our discussion of leadership, is that we can't always sit back and try to predetermine what the effect of our work is going to be. A leader has to have in his mind what he wants to do. He has to have faith that it can be accomplished. And then he just has to keep working at it until it gets done. Now, some of you lead or have led in different capacities in the work that you do, the secular work you do. What would happen if you had an idea of what needed to be done, and your first thought was, well, I just can't do it. Well, it doesn't get done at all then. It goes from good idea to nothing immediately. Or sometimes you can have an idea of what needs to be done, and you set out to do it, and you tell the people you're trying to lead what you need to get accomplished, and they say, oh, I don't think we want to do that. So you quit. Nothing gets done. Zip. A leader can't be that sort of person. A leader has to know what he wants to do, believe that it can be done, and keep working at it until it gets done. You all know that in your secular work if you do any sort of leading. In all of these examples, Joshua, Josiah, Ezra, and Amos are all examples of men who knew what needed to be done. They believed enough in God that it could be done, and they kept working until in their lifetimes they accomplished for God what needed to be done. They were leaders. Let me go back to where we began. We lack leadership among us. We're wanting too much for that body that we have a hard time describing ourselves as being part of, the church. We want somehow the church just miraculously, I guess, to do it, to save us, to teach our children, to teach the world, and yet we're not willing to be a part of leading and making the church do it, causing the promises of God to occur. We do too much preaching that is pushing and not pulling. We're all the time pushing somebody else to do it. Instead of getting out there and doing it ourselves and taking our brother or sister by the hand and bringing them with us while we do it. Now, when I want something done at work, a lot of times you can write this little note of what you want done and send it all around, and that's pushing. There's often a lot of resistance to that when you keep sending out memos all the time. I want this done. I want that done. We get memoed out. But if you really want something done, you get out front and you lead and you show them how it's done. And when you've showed them, then they know how it's done. They've seen how it's done. They have an example of how it's done, and they know you're willing to do it and willing to do the same thing that you're asking them to do. For those of you that aren't Christians, you're my final argument this morning. You need to start leading. Those of you that have sat in this auditorium and in these classes week after week and year after year and know what the gospel teaches, and there's a good half dozen of you at least here this morning, what you're doing is abdicating leadership over your own life. You know, Brother Hoagland kept writing IQ on the board, and every one of you has the IQ, so I know that isn't the problem. And he wrote honesty on the board. I'm not sure about that. And he wrote study on the board, and I know you've studied, and I know you know enough to do it. So come back to honesty. And I think really that you want to be honest, but I think what the problem is that you're not willing to take a lead of your own life. You're wanting to go where other people are going, and that can be disastrous. Most people are not going to see the promises of God fulfilled in their life, that is, the good promises. You need to take a lead. Look at these men of the Old Testament. They knew what God could do. They believed that God would fulfill His promises. They understood where they wanted to go, and they did what was necessary to get there.
That's what leadership is all about.
And so this morning, when we stand and sing this invitation song, my plea to you is to think about your life, where you want to go, and take charge of it. If you want to spend your life here on this earth enjoying the things that are around about you, and that's all you want, just sit there. But if you have any desire, any hope of going to heaven when this life is over, you're going to have to take control of your life and do something, and you're going to have to keep doing as long as you live. That's our plea, and we invite you to come while we stand and sing.